You're listening to Jewels and Bullets, the UMI Discography Podcast, a show where a UMI fan and a UMI super fan discuss each of the band's records. I'm Tommy Waits, an Aussie writer and podcaster who's based out of Atlanta, Georgia. And I'm the UMI fan in the equation. My co-host and UMI super fan is Sydney Sider, Jono Duncan, the host of the Progressive Rugby League podcast and general man about town. Jono, how are you?
Oh, I'm really good, Tom. You know, feeling good, feeling refreshed. You know, new year, same me. So how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. And we should let the listener know, between drinks, between episode 9 and this episode 10, well, we met in the flesh for a brief couple hours at the airport in Sydney when I was on my way over to Perth for the Christmas holidays. And Jono navigated the horrific Sydney traffic to come and say g'day and enjoy a $37 pint of beer at the airport with my good self and my fam. And that was rather pleasant.
It was an absolute pleasure. It was great to see in the flesh after what a good 6 or 7 years. So what a good couple of hours to sort of, you know, say g'day and talk about old times. We didn't even talk about the pod.
No, we didn't talk about the pod. Yeah, that's kind of what I was just thinking, is that we managed to hang out for a couple of hours and no Timmy or UMI talk. So yeah, that was pretty something. But yeah, we'll make up for it today. As I mentioned, it's episode 10. We're talking Porridge and Hot Sauce from 2015. And before we get stuck into the record, the regular disclaimer: myself and Jono are in no way affiliated to UMI. We're just two fans talking music for the love of the game. If you found this show, there's a good chance you're already familiar with the group known as UMI. But if not, listen to their records, go to their shows, send them all your money and love. They bloody deserve it. Jono, you seem like a man who, when doing a Secret Santa with some office pals with a $20 price point, you would do a quick online barcode check after you've been gifted your Prezi. Mm-hmm. And if you find that the RRP is $17.99, you will hold a private vendetta against everyone in the pool for the rest of your days. What I'm trying to say is that Jono is a cheapskate. No, I'm not. I'm trying to say is that Jono is a man who likes to do things by the book. So, Jono, how do you think my legal disclaimer holds up from a court of law perspective?
Well, I'll let the record show that I would get that $2.01 back somehow, somehow. Look, you know what? I sense a spin-off series where people suggest doing cool things and I just listen and just answer, I'm not sure that's a good idea. I think we're all good.
All right, great. Well, as usual, the format for the show will be myself and Jono will have a bit of chat about what led up to the recording of Porridge and Hot Sauce. Then we'll go through the record track by track. Finally, we'll tie up a few loose ends in terms of what happened after the album came out with the band and everyone involved. And then we'll give our much-awaited gold, silver, bronze medals for our favorite three tracks, our respective three favorite tracks on the record. So, Jono, we had the self-titled UMI come out in 2010, and so it's 5 years between that record and this one. What are the bullet points in terms of what's happening with the band?
Yeah, look, in terms of what's happening with the band, like you say, it's been 5 years in between. You know, Tim's done a solo record, Roger sings Rogerstein. The band did their Hi-Fi Way, Ali Daily anniversary shows and anniversary releases of their first three albums with all the extra material. Tim does the Rules of Attraction with the Bamboos in early 2015. So there's quite a bit going on. But by the time they get to Porridge and Hot Sauce, there's a lot of water under the bridge. You know, the lives have continued to evolve. For me personally, I should start off by sharing how I reacquainted myself with Porridge and Hot Sauce, because it may or may not influence how I convey my perceptions of this very record. In the normal course of events, I'll listen to a record, usually via the compact disc format, somewhere, somehow in my house. I might put it on the living room and just take it in, or maybe I'll crank it in the kitchen while washing the dishes or something. You know, I want to make sure my mind is fairly unoccupied. You know, I wouldn't put it on while trying to master a new recipe, for example. But anyway, as opposed to getting amongst a record within the four walls, I actually refamiliarized myself with porridge and hot sauce within the four doors. On a road trip in New Zealand, I was in New Zealand over Chrissy and New Year, and I put this record on a few times while driving to and from the Coromandel Peninsula from Auckland. And I'm happy to say it was a fine driving accompaniment, not a road album. They aren't driving songs per se, but they absolutely work in that setting. You know, windows down, sun blazing, winding coastal roads, and you are my energy. You know, superb stuff. And so I wanted to paint that picture, because I don't know if it's a coincidence, but my broad take on the album is related. And so listening to Porridge and Hot Sauce over my New Zealand sojourn, it was like a summer mixtape to me. You know, every song seemed to tackle a different sub-genre, and it felt like it had some loose summer vibes. When I was a kid, my parents had a record player. We had four albums. I think we had ABBA, we had Elvis, we had some country compilation, and Sesame Street, the album. And I used to love listening to Sesame Street because they were cool songs, but also it made me feel all warm and fuzzy because all my favorite characters would make an appearance and would seem to be having an awesome time. And I had a similar feel when listening to this over the summer break. Here I was driving through the dappled light of a canopied coastline, and who would happen to appear but my favorite characters, Timmy, Rusty, Andy and Davey. How wonderful. And they seem to be having a great time themselves. And trying to take myself back to the mid-2010s when they would have been talking about putting a record together, I can imagine the band talking eagerly about the records they'd been listening to and about the urge to get loose in the studio and muck around with a few of the different styles they'd dug over the previous 5 years. Because, yeah, like it was 5 years between their self-titled and Porridge and Hot Sauce. And so being out of the usual cycle of record making where you might release something every couple of years, you know, they're not worrying about what happened last time or, you know, a departure or a cultivation of a certain sound. They're at the point where they can just say, hey, fellas, let's get together and record a record. You know, so much happened in between, so there's no real point of sort of referencing or worrying about what's happened in the past. And I think the result is varied. It is loose. And I would say Porridge and Hot Sauce is bordering on joyous. Now, a couple of these songs just could not have been created without their creators being totally enamored with what they do and with each other. So, you know, I don't know if you'd call it a UMI summer mixtape of new tunes, but I did love it. And it did give me the warm and fuzzies, and it made driving up the coast an even bigger pleasure.
Yeah, so a lot of the anecdotes that we'll be sharing later, Tim Rogers gave a interview with Rolling Stone Australia, which is kind of a track by track, his thoughts on each song on this record. And so myself and Jono will reference those as we kind of share our own thoughts on the songs. And the great man does seem to reference that many of these tracks were recorded in a kind of steamy studio. The record was recorded in the Daptone House of Soul studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Mm. I was fortunate enough to live in New York for 6 or 7 years, and the summers are stiflingly hot. It seems hotter there because you guess you're compressed and you're stacked on one another. And Tim references that a lot of the songs were recorded in a steamy studio, so I think that I can definitely pick up on the summer vibes. And you know, for me, just from a very from 30,000 feet looking at the last record, self-titled, Stripping Things Back, This Is Us, This Is What We Do, Porridge and Hot Sauce is kind of like almost the teenage fantasy of a band of like, let's do something silly, let's come up with a ridiculous album title, which it's almost kind of like a joke on the media or the journos who have kind of bigged them up and then taken them down a peg as they kind of, you know, became unquote-unquote uncool. And so by coming out with the Porridge and Hot Sauce album title, you force these people to say this ridiculous phrase again and again. So I kind of see that there's kind of like boyish humor weaved in, and yeah, a lot of joy as well. So I think that there was something, I think it was in that actual Rolling Stone article where it was like, don't call it a comeback. What is it? There's Michael Dwyer stopped short of calling it a comeback, instead wisely opting to mimic the band's own attitude towards their current position within Australian music. There's nothing like a gleeful middle finger to signal an unrepentant return.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess I did say that there's, you wouldn't think of it as like a reaction to a previous albums, because we did note in the earlier in the series that especially the first 7 or 8 albums, each new album was a kind of departure and perhaps a reaction to the previous one. And I'm saying here that this is not necessarily the case, because it's been 5 years and a lot's happened since. But you could make the argument that the UMI self-titled album was a pretty kind of serious, you know, marker of, you know, this is who we are and this is how we roll, where this is just more fun. It's just we've gone from super serious to super fun. So maybe there is some kind of reaction and departure that maybe was purposeful or maybe not.
Defos. All right. Track one, Good Advices. Jono, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I love when a record opens proceedings by slapping you across the face. You know, there's no half measures in this song. If you approach listening to this song without full commitment, you'll leave worse for wear. So you're better off getting up for it and getting off on it, because you'll have a blast. I love trying to work out how Rusty plays his role here. He's kind of like a seasoned bouncer, keeping things tight when he has to, but letting the throng have their fun when the time's right. And watching him do this on this tune live is even better. He kind of bounces around the kit at various parts of the song. But more broadly, listening to this album while driving is a really instructive way to easily identify the tunes that where Rusty really stands out. You know, regular listeners will have heard me speaking about my involuntary tendency to slap thighs while listening to UMI. Well, you can't do that while driving, obviously, but you can do the next best thing, and that's slap that steering wheel. And Good Advices is a tune where the steering wheel gets an absolute workout. So, yeah, Rusty really owns this song, I reckon. In terms of the subject matter, you know, I think it's effectively about the very modern phenomenon of unlimited communication paradoxically leading to lower quality communication, you know, loose opinions stacking up into the millions, you know, saying more, meaning less, that sort of thing. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think this is a great way to kick off the record. My association with this type of song is that I've been the type of person where I have sometimes made the mistake, or perhaps it's not a mistake, depends how you want to look at it, of starting my weekend a few hours earlier than the average 9 to 5, where it's like, all right, let's have a liquid lunch on a Friday arvo, or like, yeah, let's kick things off. And this is the type of song where you walk out of the pub at maybe like 4 or 5 o'clock, a bit pissed already, and you're like, shit, I'm way ahead here, and I'm on my way to the next engagement, which is going to involve more imbibement and alcohol. And so, but what I've tended to do in the past is get in an Uber and then put on a tune that says, no, there's nothing wrong. You're ahead. These people want to be where you're at. You're a genius. You're winning. Exactly. And, so yeah, this is the something where I'd hop in the Uber, the obligatory "Hey, you doing, mate?" To the Uber driver, then the AirPods on, and then this tune super loud, so you can kind of observe everyone else who's just getting out of the office and it's about to begin, and you think, "Ha ha, I'm one step ahead of you." But
yeah.
Do you care for the good advices? Do you care for the loose opinions? Who cares? That's basically the takeaway that I get here. But really, I think the first three tracks, almost, it's there's not really too much of a lyrical takeaway. It's more about the vibe, the noise, the riffage, and so I think that Tim's the storyteller. There's always something weaved in there, but for me, I think it's definitely it reminds me of the fun times I've had in Melbourne, day drinking, and kind of the mystery that lies ahead when you're ahead of everyone else.
Yeah, yeah. And let's have a look at what Tim said about this particular song. He says, "With all the songs I contributed, this started during the golden hour of dusk, a rusty-sounding electric guitar, an amp made from a cigarette packet and a cheap local brew, an enthusiastic, loving wink to Perry Ubu, White Denim and the Johnny Burnett Trio. I could hear Russ combining the phrases with feels like sweet jam and rolled Madeira cake. I suggested the one in the rhythm track that the other guys didn't enjoy, but in a rare moment of pique, I persisted after a bottle shop run and emerged vindicated." I'm not exactly sure what all that means, but that's Tim's take.
Yeah, it's, you and I working very well together as a band.
Exactly.
It kicks off this record. So track two, Bon Vivants, Jono.
Yeah, this tune flows nicely after Good Advices, I reckon. After the kind of full frontal assault of that track, we get kind of the build from the initial intro lick into a nice assured rhythm and chorus. I'd say this song is the one I'd nominate as the driving song of the album. And, let's exist on the crumbs of a beauty not begun. I know you could feel the same way. It's like a Silver Linings type of song is my vibe on that. So, yeah, I like it.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that jump out at me for this one. So I had a feeling I knew what it meant, but I just did the old am I crazy Google double check. Bon Vivants is a person who enjoys a sociable and luxurious lifestyle. So sure. Kind of a bohemian, if you will. But there's a couple of things. So one was Tim's got this great habit where he's got a few like vocal tics that he implements in the studio and live. One is the oft used fuck yeah. He also does this other thing I've noticed quite a lot, and he does it to great effect on this, where he has his singing voice, and then at the end of the line he'll drop to his speaking voice and it creates a cool effect. So in this one he sings a line and then he says let's do it. There's something really, I don't know, it sounds really cool. And I don't know, it's getting a little bit music journo, a bit wanky here, but it kind of breaks the fourth wall a little bit. You kind of enter the studio a little bit. You feel like watching on, you're fucking like hanger on in the band. Like you're seeing it unfold. And it's kind of like a meta approach to songwriting as well, where you're like, yeah, this, we're just having fun here, we're screwing around and flicking between the different voices. So I've kind of known Tim does that a bunch, but for some reason this jumped out at me when I listened to this.
Yeah, you're right. When you say that, I am transported immediately into the studio watching Rusty kind of do his kind of maybe like a shuffly kind of beat at various parts of this track. So yeah, I see what you're saying there. Yeah.
And I guess the other, this is once again leaning on kind of the stuff he talks about in Detours, just in respect to being popular in the 90s, getting promised like, yeah, you can go to LA and be popular and have tons of money, and the tons of money stuff not really working out, but learning to appreciate the freedom that comes with being able to be an artist that people love as you grow older and, still getting to tour and all that stuff. And maybe you don't have a fancy car or a house or whatever, but you still get to do what you love. And I was reminded of this thing that one of my favorite writers, Irvin Welsh, the author of Trainspotting, says. He grew up working class or lower, I don't know how working class, but not that rich. But then when these kind of pompous writers from The Guardian would try and say, how does it feel like you've graduated from working class to be middle class? And he says, oh, I'm not middle class, I'm upper class. Now, I'm an artist, as a fuck you to the guy who does have a house, but is still very much in the 9-to-5 schedule. So I think of this song as kind of like embodying that, and celebrating that kind of like, if you've got to a point where people will come out to your shows and all that stuff, and you can live life on your own terms and appreciate the beauty wherever you can find it, then you're doing pretty fucking well. And you are an upper class gent, in my opinion.
Yeah, so I love that. Yeah, and let's see what Tim thinks about this song. He says, through that Rolling Stone, he says, some songs in this record are less stories and more quixotic little lessons I want to reiterate to myself as a code to living well. Bon Vivant is about generosity and appreciating the treasures within meager surroundings to share amusement and absurdity. So, yeah, I think there's a lot in what you said there as well. So, yes, a good tune, and I think that is – that is like a common theme with Tim over the years, when he also when he did his TV show as well. It was kind of like, you know, making the most out of what has happened to him and the situation he finds himself in. You know, his you know, mid-level fame, you know, just maximizing that and just kind of playing up to the character that he's kind of created but is also being created for himself, and sort of playing with that mythology a little bit. Yeah.
So track three, we've got a minor blue. And just before I get your thoughts, John, I just want to say the riffage that begins and ends this track. If this riff tried to walk through my door, I would hose it down before I got to my living room. The filthiest, scuzziest riff you can possibly imagine. I wouldn't let it anywhere near my good settee. But what an absolutely cacophonous and beautiful amalgamation of scuzz that kicks off this tune.
It does go pretty hard. A bit of, I guess, what you call it, a post grunge feel. So we're going through different subgenres already in the first three songs. They're quite different from each other. There's no real musical thread that I can sense. But yeah, I love how it kind of musically, it has that kind of real dirty feel. But then as it gets into the song, it goes deeper when you think it's just about to ascend. They kind of like the bass line sort of goes lower instead of, you know, ascending up. And it looks like a really satisfying song to play live too. It's a really powerful lead lick. Then it's got some cool guitar feedback moments and just thick bass as well, I think. So really, really like intense, in your face kind of tune, but in a different way to Good Advices, which is more like a sort of garage song. This is kind of more, I guess, a post grunge kind of feedbacky, hard push right in your face kind of tune.
Yeah, the bit that you mentioned where it sinks down and kind of gets, you know, goes lower where you're expecting it to go the other way. That it reminds me a little bit of the track The Ocean from the self-titled, in terms of that kind of the heft of the sound that they kind of produce in that section. So let me do Timmy's thoughts on a Minor Blue. Tim says, or how to stop worrying and love Swerve Driver, an unholy thump that is like wrenching your spleen out to play live. Wayne, our impossibly handsome engineer at Daptone, referred to it as a minor blues. I may have shrunk physically from embarrassment at that point. Rogers, writing a blues? Please look away. So, yeah, I guess that explains the track title. And, just in terms of the, yeah, exactly, and a minor blue. Yeah,
I wasn't sure if that reference there was Wayne saying A minor blues, as in like, you know, the chord A minor.
Yeah,
A minor blues, as in like one minor blue. But either way, Tim shrunk from embarrassment and had to kind of make that clarification in the song title. I like it.
Yeah, my interpretation was that Wayne was saying it's like A minor, the chord. But oh, yeah. I was always under the impression that A minor was the sad chord. It doesn't necessarily sound that sad, but yeah. There's a lot of scuzz. There's a lot of stuff going on. Either way, I'm hosing it before it comes in into my family home. That's all you need to know. All right, moving on. Track 4, Two Hands. Jono, take us away.
Yeah, a bit of soul. This record, as you mentioned, was recorded at the Daptones House of Soul in, is it Bushwick or Bushwick, New York?
Yeah, Bushwick. Yeah, Bushwick. Brooklyn.
I think Rusty had a contact from his record label days, apparently. And look, if you're going to record an album in such a storied location, you'd be tempted to lay down a bit of soul. And it comes off well. I got to say, back in 2015 when this came out, the tune didn't quite grab me. It wasn't one of my faves of the album, but you know, on the road, as I mentioned, I did feel the beauty of it, actually. And the only thing I would say as a mild note is that the female soul vocals, which are fantastic, they just sound a little sampley for some reason when I'm listening to it. But it's a comment at the margins. I think the song works really well. And it's a very different tune. You know, like we're going through different subgenres in this record already. There's four. But also it's different to pretty much anything that you and I have recorded before and since.
Yeah, I think for me, I remember hearing this single at the time and thinking like, oh, he's doing this stuff with the Bamboos and there's, you know, he's kind of bringing that world a little bit into the UMI world and where they were recording. I think there was obviously something coming through there as well. And I don't know, I just probably, for me, I Got Burned, that song that he did with the Bamboos, I felt like that was kind of like a very much like a vocal triumph for Tim, for someone where he was like, you know, shy about his voice for years, and you know, around this time or maybe a couple of years before this record, he was talking about, oh, we should just get it in another singer into UMI. I'll just be the guitarist, I'll be the rock pig guitarist and be happy as a pig and shit. I reckon, you know, it's voices, that's the cool thing about rock voices, they change over time, they mature, and I think that there's definitely kind of like the music nerd within Timmy, I think, he's able to kind of like adopt different voices to suit his tracks. Mm-hmm. And that's a really important skill, I think, if you want to have a long career and not write the same song every single time. So
yeah,
I think this Two Hands and then also I Got Burned are examples of like the, if you give someone time and let that voice mature, the cool results that can come with it. In respect to this song, I would tend to agree. It didn't blow me away at the time. I liked it a bit more this time around. And in terms of lyrical content, referencing Rosie, I'm pretty sure that's the real name of the hurricane in his missus, right? Yeah. And so as far as I can tell, it's basically like, if you don't have much, if you got a bit of love, you're doing all right. Is that the kind of takeaway?
Yeah, I would think so. And I agree with you when you talk about his voice. I mean, we have spoken about it in the past. It's not, you know, the most perfect voice technically, but he does things that no one else can. And he has a unique and idiosyncratic voice. And yeah, I Got Burned and Two Hands are good examples there. Let's have a look at what Tim says about this song. He says, "Sometimes you have to let your hands go wandering when writing music. Don't trust your logic and lessons always. Go wandering some. That's how the music was written here. It is from a suite of songs I had for a project called Tuesday Night on the Tiles with the Misses that was brushed aside when the bat phone rang to say we could do a UMI album. The session doing horns at Daptone was gloriously crowded, loose, smoky, boozy, and again, loose. Good times on a hot, muggy Monday night in Bushwick. The session with the glorious Wolfgram sisters, Talia and Eliza, was similarly full of laughter and libation. This is sung from the heart and lungs, and I still got a little hand in mine." Yeah. So yeah.
Feels like we got Timmy as a guest. And that we can kind of throw it to Tim a little bit here. It's hilarious. Cool. All right. So that's Two Hands. Track 5, One Drink at a Time. Jono, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, look, the I think the sign of a good songwriter is when you can describe the common in a different way. So a song that describes digging someone is fairly common in pop music, but for me, Look Me in the Eye and Come Get to Know Me One Drink at a Time is a direct but also a sweet, evocative and refreshing way of describing it. A really lush tune with some nice string accompaniments. And this is probably the song that grabbed me initially back in 2015 when I heard the album. This was probably my favorite song at the time. And once again, it's a different sort of subgenre, more in that lush feel. And so this is why, as I'm driving through on my road trip, I'm like, geez, this is kind of like a mixtape of new songs from my favorite band. So yeah, a nice track.
Yeah, I think it's good advice to look me in the eye, come get to know me one drink at a time. Mm. You can think of things as a drinking session, like this is just one block of hangout, or you can be like, each new drink is a new opportunity. Anything can happen. I'd never really thought of it like that, but and I'm gonna say something extremely basic bitch now, whereas like I heard strings and my first note that I wrote down was like, reminds me of Ellie Daly. So I'm sure that's gonna draw the ire of Jono, but I think there is a little bit, you know, in terms of the latter half of Ellie Daly, some kind of wistful moments. I think it's somewhat similar in terms of, but it could just be the strings. But I definitely think this is one song where, you know, with some tracks, you feel like the strings are potentially superfluous. You know, they've just been added on or over eager producer. I think for this one, if it didn't have strings, I'm not sure if this track would work. It's like an integral part of the mix.
Yeah, it does provide a bit of swing to it. And I think that's where you're coming from in terms, because they do have strings throughout some previous albums as well, beyond Ellie Daly. But this, I kind of get what you're saying, is that it provides a bit of swing in a similar way that the strings and the horns did in Ellie Daly. So, yeah, I get it.
All right, let me do the Timmy. Let's throw to Timmy here. I'll do my Tim voice. No, I won't do that. All right, so one drink at a time. Tim says, I wrote the music in 1998 while I was living in Los Angeles and came back to it every year since, prompted by Davey's ever-continuing majesty and his gentle encouragement. I pushed in some lyrics I had from the Tuesday Night Project, and the scansion fit well. Strings adorned by Ross James Irwin, who I met when I started with the Bamboos. We get into shorthand when talking real quick. Another example of it, don't matter how you got somewhere, you just got to get on with getting to the next place. An absurdly talented musician who is also a sweetheart. So yeah, I always find that intriguing when a track has been around, kicking around for a long time, and then the right people come together to bring it to fruition. So
yeah, well, you've got 1998. It's just after the Ellie Daly. Well, it's kind of number four era, but it's not too far of a departure from that. So yeah, there is a link there, I suppose.
All right. So that's one drink at a time. Track six, Out to the Never Now, which I believe is the first non-Rogers pen track from the entire UMI discog, right?
Well, yeah, I think there's definitely been some co-writes, but this would be the first one where it's someone totally different writing the tune, and it's introducing Davey Lane. He's making his UMI songwriting debut. Obviously, he came on board, as we mentioned, over the last several episodes at the Saturday Night Round 10 live album, and then in the studio through Dress Me Slowly. But here he's making his UMI songwriting debut. Obviously, he, you know, has his own band, The Pictures, and has written and done a million things and is very accomplished in and of his own right. But I guess it would have been a bit nervy for him, I wonder. He would have been given the go-ahead. I'm sure Tim and the band would have been very eager to give him, you know, this opportunity, or maybe just happened naturally, I'm not sure, but I'm sure there would have been some trepidation from Davey. But it's a beauty. It's a great leading lick. It's a bit psychedelic, maybe. Is it maybe a bit of a sci-fi-ish feel? I can kind of picture Doctor Who traveling through time with this track in his tape deck. But yeah, it sounds like Davey, but also sounds like you and I. I think it works well.
Yeah, I had chase scene from the Power Rangers or like kind of some King Gizzard vibes. And like, hasn't Davey Lane worked with Todd Rundgren? That dude. So there's that kind of like, yeah, late 60s, early 70s kind of psychedelic proggy type of stuff. And I definitely think this is the right record for this particular Davey song to be on. You know, it would be a stretch to see this song on like the self-titled. It would be pretty jarring. Yeah. And I guess I feel like with a lot of these tracks, they do a really good job of capturing the fun of the live performance. I think this one is potentially a little bit more, the production has been a little bit more focused on. And for me, this is one of those tracks where it's like, I'd love to see this live and feel the kind of power of it come together. Versus the studio recording, which I think is good. But I would be more inclined to want to see this live is my kind of vibe. I think it would just have more power performed live. But
yeah,
maybe it's just because it's sandwiched around other songs where there's a lot more loose, sloppy, let's just record it all together live in the studio vibe. That's perhaps why I'm sensing that.
Yeah. Yeah. Once again, as you kind of referenced there, it's another subgenre, I guess. And I feel like we've got six from six different subgenres in this album. So this is kind of, maybe a psychedelic-y, sci-fi-ish feel. But yeah, I have not seen this particular song live, but as you're saying that you'd like to see it, I can kind of imagine, because that leading lick is the centerpiece of the song, and it's a ripper, and I can kind of imagine it kind of crackling through the humid air of a 1500 strong crowd kind of thing. So yeah, that would be a good song to see live.
Yeah, also something that I didn't pick up on my first couple listens, but on the third or fourth time round, I noticed that someone's going to fucking town on the bongos in the background towards the end. Really hammering the bongos. And it made me and I loved it. I thought it kind of added to it because, it's got that chase scene element to it where it's climaxing. Everything's going off.
You need a bongo.
And so the bongo adds something. And I realized – I'm a man who really likes one bongo, one person on the bongos. If this add two people on the bongos, I fucking hate it. It's a drum circle. I don't want to be anywhere near it. But one person on the bongos, I'm there all day. Deep Purple.
Yeah.
Plenty of other acts that they've whipped out the BGs for a track or two, and I don't mind it. As soon as we get more than one person on them, I'm out of there. So that's my what are your thoughts on the bongo?
It does beg the question, how do you play the bongos without looking like a bit of a tool? It's like a bit of that sort of drum circle vibe, a bit of let's hold hands around and sort of someone play the bongos and let's think about spirituality or something. But I agree. A bit of bongo, not too much bongo. Totally with you.
Yeah.
Bongo. Anyway, one bongo.
There's got to be a bongo quota. There's a guy on the side of the stage in a high-vis shirt letting people on and off the stage.
He's like, whoa, this right. Looks like a drum circle. Off you go.
All right. Tim's thoughts. He says, Davey Lane's torrid forest of imagination is a landscape of fecundity. Now, that's one lofty, lysergic sentence of a mess, not worthy to describe David's caudal sensibilities. Forgive me, it's cocktail hour. I'd love to hear his take on the hows and whys of this song, but its sweet mystery intoxicates me every time. Play on, sweet David, play on.
That kind of makes me think, I've often thought this because I've never been in a band, but I wonder what it's like when a songwriter or various songwriters bring songs to the table. It sounds like every time that I hear band members talk about this kind of experience, that they never ask the obvious question of, well, so what's it about? What's it about? It's kind of like, here's the song, don't ask about it. Let's just work out how we work it musically. But I get the feeling that it might be a really deep song that's brought to the band, and it's just like a no-go area in terms of asking. So what did you mean about that? Who are you talking about there? Like, that's my initial reaction would be to work out what it's all about and go through line by line. So on line, so verse 3, line 2, who are you talking about there? But I think, you know, being part of a band means you're much cooler than me, and you just kind of let these things fly and just go, yeah, it's a tune up. I don't need to know they're going through what they're going through. Let's just make it sound as good as possible.
I've thought the same thing. And the song that always springs to mind, or rather the mythology around the song, is Rosanna, the song by Toto, released in 1982, which was apparently inspired by the actress Rosanna Arquette, sister of David Arquette. She starred in Pulp Fiction, a bunch of other things in the 90s. But it was written, someone was in the band was dating her, but it was written by someone else in the band.
Oh, wow.
The guy who's dating Rosanna Arquette, he shows up to practice one day, and the other guy's like, oh, I've written this song. What's it called? It's called Rosanna. And so I've always wondered, like, how did that, because, and then it becomes a huge hit. So then you're like, well, I don't know. Does Rosanna Arquette fall in love with the other guy because he made this great song?
Yeah. It would be like, is this about this Rosanna? No.
Different one, mate. Yeah. It would be, yeah. So anyway.
Well, I only know one Rosanna? Come on.
Okay. So that's track 6.
Mm.
Track 7 is Demons, but spelt weird. Yes. Jono. What are your thoughts? It's like
a ye olde English spelling, maybe. But
Aleister Crowley shit. Weird stuff. Yeah.
So I think it's a great little song that kind of hints at the mythology of Rogers that I touched on earlier, the demons that he's faced. And through this tune, it seems like he's found a way to deal with it, to frame it in his mind. He is the kind of rare figure, a rare modern figure, in that, you know, he's a fairly ordinary guy, as his book highlights, but he maintains a bit of mystique. He's a living, breathing figure of mystique a little bit. And that probably resolves somewhat around the demons he's faced over the years, you know, quite publicly at times. So his solo stuff probably plays with this terrain a bit more, but this essentially solo tune fits kind of snug in what is otherwise a pretty loud ensemble creation. And it doesn't jar. It kind of works well. So I would say that I want to mention I came across a Guardian review of Porridge and Hot Sauce from 2015. I think it gave the album 3 stars or something, you know, which, you know, whatever. But what got my goat was that the review revolved around this song and basically said, you know, Demons is a key tune in this album, and it shows, you know, Tim has dealt with these demons. But the article basically says that Yomar would basically be better if he was still struggling with those demons. You know, like, he misses the old time when he was struggling and it was a bit more tension. And I was just thinking, what a bizarre kind of lazy take on the old, you know, I like your old stuff better than your new stuff trope. And I was just kind of like, okay, 3 stars, whatever, you know, take or leave those kind of reviews. But that kind of positioning of that article about this album was, I just felt totally unfair. But I'm obviously coming from a super fan subjective perspective, but I have read, you know, many, you know, poor reviews or whatever over the years, or people who think differently about you and my to me. But that one annoyed me just because it's like, I felt like it was just a lazy way of saying, I can't be bothered and I just want to listen to the old stuff, you know, and using like kind of his struggles with various things over the years. Was, I don't know, it just annoyed me.
It also, the way the lyric says, if I don't let him in, as in his demons, if I don't let him in, some other fool will, maybe they won't come back again.
Mm.
Yeah, it's the way, I don't think this song is simply like, oh, I'm I'm over that shit. I'm all good now. It's more a sense of acceptance and not trying to battle your own demons and just being like, well this is who I am and dealing with it. And therefore you can learn to manage it. Or, you know, it's like, it's not as simple as like, I used to be fucked up. Now I'm all good. It's all gravy, baby. So that's, it sounds like a pretty simplistic view, but I agree. I like how the album comes down a notch. I think it's kind of necessary. The energy it's pretty intense for the first six tracks. So I think it's nice that it comes down. Once again, kind of like a Detours reference. He says, you know, walk in all directions, just pounding north, south, east and west. That's really all I got on this one. I think it's a great track. And, I just think it's a nice fits in snug as a bug in a rug.
Let's see what Tim thought about it. He says, I didn't imagine any slower tunes or spare vignettes on this record, but at the encouragement of Andy Kent, I proceeded to record this with John Castle in a small string ensemble. John's contribution to our record cannot be underestimated. He has a wild enthusiasm and a wicked intelligence that is very attractive. He pushed me on the vocals on this one, and I'm so glad he did. It was written initially for An Actor Retires, a stage show I was working on. Of course, I think his most recent solo album is called An Actor Repairs. So maybe it was kind of that kind of thing. And that album actually has a bit of a stagey vibe to it. But yeah, interesting. Thanks, Tim.
All right. Track 8, Beehive. Jono, what are your thoughts?
Oh, I love this song. This is a big, sweet sing-along chorus that is irresistible to me and my sensibilities, with references to sort of puckering up and the honey in the cup. And I feel like I'm in the middle of a slightly subversive children's tale. I can see Tim and Davey sliding down a giant, undulating, golden, slippery dip for some reason, and I want to get on that slippery dip. But I really love this song. It's, once again, very different to anything else on the album, but it's up there for me.
Yeah, I tend to disagree a little bit. I think this album ends really strong from like track 10 onwards, pretty much. I think we've referenced this before, but you know, like bands will often slip in the least strong track as the second last track. For me, this is kind of, I don't know, got slightly second last track vibes. I think this is a strong album, so I feel this is very light criticism. I guess I just don't like this one as much as other tunes. But I will draw attention. So I think Tim's voice on this one is really great, especially the O's. I think he does a great job there. And but that's my kind of take there. I'll give Timmy a chance to retort here. So Tim says, wonderfully collaborative amongst the band as they wrestled with a winsome little tune with a baffling bridge that opens out into a chorus like a newly popped bottle of Côtes du Rhône in a field of dancing satyrs. Timmy, mate, you've read the dictionary more than I have. I don't know what you're saying half the time. Rusty's drum parts mapped with Andy's bass are highlights for me. And then Cheeky Davey adds piano, all played and recorded live on a sweaty Arvo in Brooklyn. We were going to engineer Wayne Gordon's bar straight after the chosen take, so our enthusiasm mixed with tender care is palpable to me. We're as an excitable bunch of middle-aged men as you'd be unlucky enough to meet. We do, however, welcome you to join us if you have an appreciation of the sillier things in life.
There you go.
On your Timbo. Track 9, Buzz the Boss. What are your thoughts? Davey's back on deck.
Yeah, he's back on deck with a big sort of awesome rocker about an insufferable but ultimately, I guess, hapless boss, presumably nicknamed Buzz. Tom, I think we've all had a Buzz in our lives who's scribbling on his bullshit message board or these days on Microsoft Teams. I reckon this is a super tune. This is I have seen this one live, and it went down really well with the crowd, and it sounded awesome. And like I think a more sort of traditional rocker after Davey's kind of sci-fi-ish introduction. So he's kind of straddled a couple of ends of the spectrum. So I think it's a real solid, an excellent debut actually from Davey in these, with these songs, and I think they fit in nicely with the album.
Yeah, I think that this song, this is the right album for this song to be on, much like other Davey's other one. It's kind of fun, it's tongue in cheek a little bit, and I guess the note that I wrote down was like, weird thing to write a song about, like and it made me wonder, is that if you think about like Davey Lane's chronology, young guy transcribing stuff online, and then when he's 19 or something, he's like gets picked out of nowhere to be in UMI. So his reference for the working world was this experience flipping burgers somewhere and then dealing with this prick Buzz. And the unfortunate thing is that like, if you don't get pulled into showbiz that young, you just have to deal with an endless ongoing carousel of buzzers your whole life. And so and you mentioned before, in terms of Tim's ability to tap into the frustration and rage that you felt, or whatever you felt when you were a young man or even a kid, and having that kind of visceral, palpable memory. And I think Davey's doing something similar here. And because it did get me thinking, I worked in the fast food industry and dealt with some people who were going nowhere, and you're meant to be in that industry for 5 years tops, and then there's some people who are going to be there for a lot longer, and you have to deal with them while you're there. And so it was a flashback to me, because it was like, oh yeah, I remember my first encountering people like Buzz. But then unfortunately they follow you around just with different names and uniforms wherever you go.
It is so true. I didn't realize that it was a fast food related industry that he was working at, because when I first got into this song, I was just imagining my office life, and it can be transported, this song, fast food, or it can be in an office. There are buzzers, as you say, all through your career that you will have to deal with, and at first they are a source of frustration, but they become a source of humor soon enough. And I think that's how we're seeing Buzz. I think that's how Davey's seeing Buzz by the end of the song. And he's kind of like, at the end of the song, he kind of says, he kind of has a mea culpa, and he goes, well, I guess I really miss you, Buzz the Boss, which is nice.
Do you want to give us Tim's thoughts?
Yeah. He says, Davey returns with what I believe is a pain to a former boss at a fast food chain. He and I bonded early over tales of less than honorable overlords at restaurant chains. We bear the scars and the deep fryer burns, but emerge the victor with guitar riffs that get us all tight in the trousers. So I think that's spot on. It is a nice riff that kind of drives the song well.
All right, so track 10. I love these last four songs, kicking off with this this one, She Said Goodbye. Jono, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I love this one too. I think Davey goes above and beyond with backing vocals in general, and his contribution here is pretty important to the song, where he basically is like, given like backing vocals, to end all backing vocals, he's almost like getting himself a hernia with these backing vocals, and it's I'm thankful for that. And as I mentioned earlier about this tune, this record and its relationship to my steering wheel, the steering wheel gets another workout here. Rusty's fills are absolutely pinpoint perfect and totally on point. So, yeah, love this tune.
Yeah, my one note here was when the chorus kicks in, groovy, baby. the band playing together very, very nicely indeed. Mm. And, I just think it's a great... I think that almost kind of like the beginning tracks on this album, I guess it's a little bit more about kind of the vibe and the kind of sound scapes. And I guess towards the end, I think it's more of a focus on like the songs themselves, I guess. Maybe slightly poppier, or just like more consideration of how they're put together, as opposed to kind of like the chaos of Noah Minor Blue or Good Advices. So I don't know. I think it's still exciting and upbeat and kind of got that energy, but I think with the more kind of more of like pop rock focus, which I think is pretty cool.
I'm interested in your thoughts about, I'm thinking sometimes when I listen to UMI records, what are the most UMI tracks of each record? And I think this one would be one of those, and maybe Good Advices as well, in that I can't picture any other band being able to do a song like this, or any other modern band, or, you know, I don't have much of a breadth of knowledge as some do, but these are two songs that I just can't see anyone else trying or pulling off. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, the only other, She Said Goodbye, I guess, I remember I used to be a Jet fan a long time ago, and some of their songs on their later albums reminded me of kind of like Tim Rogers Light in terms of the songwriting. And so, yeah, there's something kind of similar there in terms of this song. But I would tend to agree. And I'd probably say that, like, it's almost, you got to split it up. It's like, what's the most like Tim song on the album? I'd probably say is Demons, because it's obviously stripped back and acoustic and the personal lyrical content and all that. But yeah, I would tend to agree. This probably has the most kind of UMI, especially with this, as you mentioned before, because on this album, they're experimenting with all the subgenres and kind of like showcasing their chops and be like, let's go over here, let's do this. Whereas this one, I think it's perhaps there's more obvious continuity with this song with prior eras of the band.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's just a really tight, high energy and, you know, joyous kind of rock and tune. And I guess that's where that kind of mixture is where I see them as a point of difference to any other band that kind of tries something similar. But that's just obviously subjective and biased and tilted. But that's just me. Let's have a look at what Tim said about this. He goes, again, written for Tuesday night, and one of the first times I've written a complete lyric in one sitting, the sitting being at my local in Golden Hour before it was invaded by obtrusive drinkers, my least favorite imbibers. There is a time to be alone. It doesn't mean you're lonely. Rusty's list of early 80s gutter punk records that he wanted John to reference in the mixing is one of my treasured pieces of literature. Up there with the Magna Carta or Neil Young's Eat a Peach letter to Stephen Stills. The lyrics are fiction, but the band's Loose Abandon is not. Now, Neil Young's Eat a Peach letter to Stephen Stills, I had a quick look at this, and the letter is as follows. Funny how things that start spontaneously end spontaneously. Eat a peach, Neil. That's I had a quick read up on that. I think they got together, Young and Stills, after, I think, beyond the Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young era for a tour or a recording or something. Maybe they did an album together. But I think Neil just left halfway through that tour and wrote a telegram to Stills saying, eat a peach.
Yeah, that's Canadian for, I hope your family dies in a car fire or something. That's a big insult up in the great white northern land.
I felt like it was like the Canadian version of, hey, Patsy, sit on it. You know, kind of like a kind of almost a wholesome way to say, get fact.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll say goodbye to She Said Goodbye and move. See what I did there. And then we'll go on to track 11, My Old Friend. Jono, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so Rusty gets a very rare songwriting credit here. This feels like one of those 60s pop rock subgenres that Rusty often rattles off so freely in interviews. You know, he's always in interviews. I notice him always kind of mentioning some sub genre that I've never kind of contemplated, and I thought it was just rock, but no, there are many different subgenres. But this tune, it might be one of those. And I love, you know, rack 'em on up, boys. Let's play. You know, it's evocative. I'm sweaty. The sun is streaming through the pub window. I'm right there. But I think this song is all about Rusty's shuffly beat. You get the feeling he's been waiting to deliver something like that for a while. You can sense his enjoyment sitting behind the kid, I reckon.
Yeah, I'm no Rusty Hopkinson, but I strongly recommend everyone checks out Nuggets, original artifacts from the first psychedelic era. It's this compilation of garage rock, 60s garage rock. And there's a bunch of different, there's like 30 tracks on that album. I think there's like a couple other albums as well. It's all that kind of 13th floor elevator stuff. And I'll quickly read out Tim's thoughts here. On this track, he said, music by Hopkinson/Rogers, a superbly stanky shuffle set up by Russ with his guitar riff reminding me of Dr. John before he got shot in the hand early on. We were going to put some big jug on this song as a loving shout out to our beloved 13th floor elevators, but left it so you can do it at home. A love letter to the perils and joys of illumination. So, yeah, there's obviously that kind of, just the guitar tone, the shuffly beat. This one's awesome. And I feel like they've definitely used the studio and their surroundings and the players to perfection here, where everything's come together. And, yeah, it definitely feels like a, Rogers mentioned prior track that She Said Goodbye was written for his Tuesday night project, and a couple of the other songs have been like repurposed, whereas this one definitely feels like Rusty said, hey, I've got this riff, and they've kind of fleshed it out and it's happened. And so I feel like that gives it kind of the energy and the spontaneity, but yeah, I love this one. Really cool.
I didn't actually notice, but in Tim's sort of missive there, he says that with his guitar riff, so Rusty did the guitar riff too, so nice work. It's right on.
Talented fella. Talented fellas. All right. So track 12, An East Doncaster Girl. They've just purposefully made all this stuff ungoogleable as well. They've all got weird spellings. My old friend, A-U-L-D. An East Doncaster Girl, G-U-R-L. Always having a bit of fun, which I think is
good. Language is fun. That is the lesson that I've taken. One similar to One Drink at a Time for me, in that there's a line that absolutely nails a feeling. You know, she's your last big chance, so don't you blow it now.
Don't you blow it now. Yeah.
It's probably very familiar to people who have had multiple long-term relationships, which is probably most people. You know, as time moves on, you start thinking about how many chances you might have left, even that, if that's like an unreasonable thought, even when people in their 30s think of that, or their 40s, even though you've got a whole bunch of life left in you. So it is an anxiety that people feel. So I think it's just a line that just absolutely nails a feeling. And I love musically how in the second half of this song, there's a bit of mashing organ. Once again, reflecting the bit of fun that they're having when they're recording this. It sounds, you know, wish I was a fly on the wall just to kind of drink in some of those vibes.
Yeah, I like this one because kind of I wrote down the exact same lyric and also very satisfying chord change that comes along with that lyric, where I think Tim's quite good at that, where he's admitted himself, where he said that, you know, like he's overly wordy, particularly with his verses, where he feels a necessity to cram in a lot of words and tell a story. But then he's also very good where he'll kind of like in the chorus, he will not use as many words and then, use great chord changes to shine a light on the melody. Mm-hmm. Whereas during the verses, just due to the fact that he's spitting a lot of shit, man, that there maybe isn't a lot a melody for you to follow, but in the chorus, I think in this one is a perfect example of how he can kind of pull that off. And yeah, just in terms of the lyrical content that you made, in terms of feeling anxious about your relationship and don't blow it now, and I just feel like, again, because it's kind of that chord change is, I guess, like a almost reminds me a little bit of a 50s love song, but through a warped filter kind of, and how I can just imagine them playing as like the coolest high school band ever and playing a school formal or something, but they're middle-aged men, and how just the concept of that uncertainty that you feel when you're a teenager trying to fall in love and dealing with all that shit, that kind of never really ends. You will always be grappling with that same shit. So, you're going to find yourself a partner, have a bit of a boogie. And,
But also that feeling, you know, that she's your last big chance, or it could be he, so don't you blow it now. That is a feeling, like you say, that goes through your life, but it also starts pretty young too. Like for a lot of people, like even if you might just be 16, but you're like, oh, you know, I've just had a girlfriend and, you know, I can't blow it now. Because you, when you're that age, you have no concept of what's ahead of you and that there is so much wide open road ahead of you. Throughout most of your life, you can't really capture or understand that concept of what's ahead or and sort of the breadth of it. So yeah, I think that it's just one line, but it kind of it makes you think.
And I'll so let's read have it a, out, Tim.
Yes, yeah, please do.
Yeah. So Tim says, I had the chords, melody, and riff from a few years back. One that I think Davey and I love more than Russ and AK, but our process for determining songs has evolved into, well, if my mate likes it, then maybe I will too somewhere down the line. A lot of trust and love goes into recording sessions that only last a few days. A few years ago, I would have stamped my feet a bit and tried the thoroughly unattractive, passive/aggressive route to get my way, but I've learned my ideas ain't necessarily going to be the best in a band where I'm the least musical one in the room.
Yeah,
so it sounds like a tale of compromise and love and respect, and we'll see what happens. Yes,
and I think like that's an interesting insight actually. I think we've all kind of, I definitely have only realized over the last few years that I probably tried on the thoroughly unattractive passive aggressive route to get my way in the past. So like it is a story of growth in many ways, that little anecdote.
Yeah. Well then taking a, you know, like it makes you wonder though, because then the Guardian guy, the snarky 3-star reporter dude would say, well, that's another perfect example of Tim's lost his edge. You know, we want him to stamp his feet. We want him to defend his songs like his life depends on it, because that gives us the singular voice that we learn to appreciate in Hi-Fi Way and Early Daily. Yeah. So, but I don't care about that because we got Hi-Fi Way and Early Daily. That's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
So why not have especially it would be a little bit different if it was like, I don't know, you're Axl Rose or something. You're signed. You have to play as Guns N' Roses. You're only going to make a record once every 7 years and you have no other outlets. Tim's got a bunch of solo stuff and he's got the twin set and all that. So you can get the Tim singular vision or the strip back Tim elsewhere. And then I like the mix up of this album.
Yeah. Fantastic.
All right. It ends with a fun one, the titular "Buy Me Dinner First" of Porridge and Hot Sauce. Jono, what are your thoughts?
Well, good question. What are my thoughts on the song or the recipe? Because I tried it. I tried this recipe, Tom.
Oh no!
The lengths I go to for UMI and this podcast. I want to say, being a super fan is three parts joyous and one part pathetic, and I get that. And I'm tempted to let the pathetic superfan part in me loose and tell you that I tried a bowl of porridge and hot sauce and I give it 5 stars. That's what a pathetic superfan would do, just to see people's reaction. I'm tempted to say that, but I resist. The truth is I did try porridge and the hottest sauce we had in the house, which was sriracha. I'm not sure, is that really hot? I don't know. For me, it is. But I'm sure hot sauce aficionados would sort of like balk and say, that's not even a hot sauce. Did I like it? Not particularly, but my lifestyle doesn't require it, so I'm not going to judge. But I got to say, like, I did I did feel sharp that morning at work, so maybe it did the trick. I don't know if that's because I slept well, but I felt super sharp that morning. I remember actually, without even knowing about what I had for breakfast or thinking about it, saying to a colleague, "I'm just like feeling so alert." We also work in an office that is like 17 degrees max, so like you're freezing, so you can't sort of get you can't get too kind of, you know, somber or too hot. But importantly, I'll get to the song. I love the song. It's a fun song. You know, that's about all there is to say about it. No need to overthink it. But it's a perfect way to polish things off on this record.
Yeah, the first track, Good Advices, reminds me of some times I spent partying with friends in Melbourne, getting stuck into the beers a little too early. And once again, Porridge and Hot Sauce reminds me a little bit of Melbourne in terms of it's an artistic city, and with artistic cities, real artistic cities, you've got real art, you've got people doing the real work, but then you've also got a lot of pretense and bullshit on top of that. And so I like the I guess maybe it's almost kind of like I'm smuggling in my hatred of foodie culture here a little bit as well, and being like, although I would never eat porridge and hot sauce voluntarily, if it was that or a $37 smashed Avo option from some pretentious cafe where it's going to be $18 for a latte on top of that,
yeah,
I'm having porridge and hot sauce every day. And give Tim's thoughts here. He says, an undignified rave up driven by cheap beer, a sweaty studio, and loud, loud music. The song title was my staple utilitarian breakfast recipe, guaranteed to keep the wolves away and with no bloody adornments or fripperies. I keep those for work. My best to you all, and may you always put your shoes and socks on in that order. So I think that there's a lesson there in that you can be distracted from, when you live in a place like Melbourne, by all the bullshit and stuff like that. And you can consider yourself an artistic person just because you're surrounded by artists, but you don't need much to do the thing. And so I kind of like the sentiment, and I like the strip back punk rave up vibe of the music as well. So, big fan of this one.
There's also a lesson there: socks before shoes, which is something that's good to remind ourselves of. But yes, I share your thoughts on foodie culture. I think we're aligned there. There are, like, when you go into a place and you walk out as more of a wanker than what you were when you walked in, that there's you shouldn't go to that restaurant or cafe, because there's so many places where, like, I've been to for various reasons, and I just sit there going, I feel like a wanker, and I feel like I'm turning into more of a wanker than I already am, and I'm already a bit of a wanker, but I don't want to be more of a wanker. So what are you doing to me, restaurant or slash vibe that you're trying to put out here? So yeah, I'm with you. Doesn't mean we don't like food. We love food. I like, I love the wonder of fruits and vegetables and nuts. They just grow and we eat them. It's amazing. But when it gets a bit complicated and a bit fancy, I'm just like, nah, count me out.
Defos. All right. Well, we did it. That is Porridge and Hot Sauce by UMI. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts in terms of, because the reviews were pretty positive across the board in terms of, people saying not necessarily like a return to form and all that stuff, but more a case of like, it's great that we've still got UMI around making records like this, but do you have any thoughts in terms of how it was received or any live shows at the time? Any thoughts in terms of what happened after this came out?
Yeah, look, I just remember it being really refreshed by the release of this record. Obviously, after UMI self-titled, it'd been 5 years, so you never really know, if they're going to come back and record or what it's going to be like. But to have, such a kind of loose and relaxed but energetic record, I feel like it's the perfect UMI release. at this time, you know. It's exactly what the doctor ordered. In terms of the reaction at the time, I feel like it was quite similar. You know, I mentioned that Guardian review. Well, it wasn't like necessarily a negative review. I think, yeah, most reviews were fairly positive. The live show I saw was at the Metro when this record was released, and it was a good show. I do remember one thing, though, that they opened with Good Advices, and this took me to – because, like, the sound of Good Advices, you know, when you go to a gig and the sound in the first couple of songs, it takes a while for the sound to kind of find its groove.
Yeah, get calibrated, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. But I've never heard anything like this, that the struggles that the sound guy was having for this particular song. It was like – I was standing near the sound desk. I remember it vividly, but it was like he'd lost total control of the soundboard. Like he was like maybe accidentally, you know, fading the guitar up to the maximum, and like each instrument had its own turn as like almost playing by itself. And I was remember thinking, what is happening? Oh, this is so sad. So the song itself didn't sound much good, to be honest, because of, you know, they were having sound troubles at the beginning there. But I do remember thinking, oh my god, like what does this mean? Like how are people gonna react? But people just reacted normally. They just cheered and yelled, and it's like, oh yeah, cool. But people, you know, people are nice, but or drunk. But yeah. I was relieved when I saw this song played again, I think at a subsequent show maybe a year or two later, and it sounded so cool. It was so like tight and in your face, and exactly how I wanted it to sound. And I'm like, oh, thank God, because I feel like I needed that to kind of cement the idea that it was a great song. Because when I first heard it, they were playing it well, but the sound was just all over the shop. Couldn't get the sense of it. So I've kind of like gone on a tangent there, but overall, good album.
All right, cool. Well, it's everyone's favorite time. They listen to this point. The podium is in front of us. Jono, yeah. What are your thoughts? Bronze, silver, and gold. Have you done your homework?
I always forget, but I'm going through it now. Let's have a look. Okay, I think I've got it. In bronze, I'm going to go with She Said Goodbye. Yeah.
Yep.
And that's all she said. And the fills and Davey's backing vocals. Yeah, I think it's a ripper. Number two, I'm going to go Buzz the Boss. I really enjoy that song. I think it's a big rockin' chorus in the true tradition of big rockin' choruses. And yeah, it takes me back to the humorous buzzes that have appeared peppered throughout my life and remain peppered in my life. And I think you're going to disagree with this one. My favorite of this album is Beehive. I think they're my sensibility, maybe. Like, I just cannot resist a sweet sing-along chorus when it's done well. And for me, that's my favorite one. And like I said, it kind of takes me on a journey. I can imagine kind of rainbows and sunshine and hopping through daisy-laden fields through that song.
Beautiful.
What about you, sir?
Just one thing I forgot to mention. Yeah, I was a big fan of Daptone Records when I was living in New York, and I got to know, well, got to see a few bands that were associated with Daptone Records. They obviously got a lot of like soul acts and stuff like that, but they had a few rockers as well, and there's this one band that are really great called the Mystery Lights.
Oh, yeah.
Who, yeah, kind of in the vein of some of the garage rock sounds that are on this record. So if you like the rocked moments on this album, give the Mystery Lights a spin, because I'm pretty sure they would have recorded in the same rooms that this record was recorded in. And yeah, they're a great band, which I believe they're still based out of New York, so might be able to see them. But Mystery Lights, good band. Meant to mention it before when we were talking about Daptone, but I forgot. All right, my podium, bronze, we got Demons. I think that it's nice to get the kind of the Tim with a capital T song on an album, that kind of personal, emotional moment is cool. Silver, I felt weird even doing this, but I checked myself because I was like, no, you like it. Porridge and hot sauce gets my silver because kind of jokey, but it's also, I don't know, it's too much fun to ignore. So it gets a silver. And the gold for me is my old friend. So Rusty's, it appears to be Rusty's riff from Tim's snippet there. And yeah, just the way the whole song comes together, the sounds great. I have to try it out in the car based on Jono's recommendation. But yeah, that's my no crossover once again. Sign of a good album.
Mm. And a sign of a good album, I think. This is, I've experienced this a few times through this series, in that you listen to an album in preparation for a podcast a few times, you know, maybe several times over the course of a week or two. And then you think you're kind of over it, but then we talk about it and then you want to hear it again sometimes. And this is definitely one of those. I'm like, oh yeah, I think I'm going to put it on tonight. Because you know, there are so many cool and fun moments and yeah, at its heart, it's a summer record, and it's summer here in Oz, even though I'm wearing a jumper. So I'm going to pop it on. So I think that's a sign of a good record.
Well, we did it. Thanks, Jono. If you're watching this on YouTube, you can drop your gold, silver, and bronze in the comments. You can hit us up via email or on Twitter. All the deets are in the episode description. And stay tuned. Next episode, we'll be talking the most recent record, The Lives of Others.
Yeah, we're getting towards the end, aren't we, Tom? It's getting a bit emotional, but no, it's good. We're this has been a fun journey, and we're close to polishing it off. So exciting!
Yeah, exciting stuff. All right, thanks everyone. Catch you next time.
Ciao.